It's the Wolfpack Live at Frankie's Eastside Gourmet and Italian Restaurant in Farmingdale, New York, featuring Big Sexy Kevin Nash, the Bad Guys Scott Hall, and the Bronco Buster himself, X-Pac Sean Waltman. VIP tickets are on sale Saturday, September 26th for amazing VIP packages starting at $75. Call 516-756-2753. Tell them the two-man power trip of wrestling sent you by using the code POWERTRIP NWO for a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's Frankie's Eastside Gourmet, an Italian restaurant in Farmingdale, New York. 516-756-2753. It's going to be an event that's just too sweet.
You might wind up in a body bag.
Good. How you doing, Chad? Hey, Johnny. Cool, man. What's going on? We ready to go or what?
This is Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
This is Scotty Riggs, and you're listening to the two-man power trip of wrestling.
Hey, man, what's up, guys? This is Homicide.
Oh, that's my homie, Homicide with a big homie club.
Yeah, that would be it.
Hey, this is David Penzer, and this is the two-man power trip of wrestling.
Well, thank you, thank you. Hear me, fear me.
What's going on, guys? This is the 7 foot, 330-pound DNA of TNA. That's right, my DNA is outer space. And you're listening to the two-man power trip of professional wrestling.
You know, I don't do many wrestling shows anymore, probably because I'm a bit ignorant. You guys probably know 10 times more than I do.
Great talking to you guys. It's been your pleasure.
They've worked in and around the wrestling business. They've studied thousands of hours of wrestling, and now they bring to you the greatest legends, Hall of Famers, creative minds, and both current and future stars of pro wrestling. They are Primetime Pod and Chad, the two-man power trip of wrestling.
This is the two-man power trip of wrestling, brought to you today and powered by Meowbox. Meowbox is a monthly cat subscription box service full of surprises and delivered to your door every single month. And make sure you stay tuned for a special offer just for the listeners of the two-man power trip of wrestling, courtesy of Meowbox and Meowbox.com. And with that being said, my name is Chad, and as always, I'm joined by my tag team partner, Primetime John Paz. And John, today we celebrate 100 episodes. That's right, 100 episodes of the two-man power trip of wrestling podcasts. And partner, what a 100 episodes it's been that have been published. We have a bunch that have yet to see the light of day. We've been recording like crazy, always trying to keep the quality as supreme as we can, bringing you guest after guest. And just great interviews after great interviews, and just trying to think outside the box and really, you know, give our spin on a business that's, you know, had it basically broadcasted every which way but loose. And we're just trying our best to do something a little bit different and present something that's unique in that, hey, whether you're a smart fan, whether you're a new fan, whether you're an old fan, whether you just want to listen to somebody talk to another person, we're very happy that you would check out the two-man power trip of wrestling. It's been an absolute roller coaster of fun from the concept that we thought of a few years back, just didn't have the right execution time around it, how it evolved. If you ever find the original episodes, which are not available on the iTunes directory, you know, they're a little different. The first six or seven episodes did not have the same interview format. Quite frankly, we abandoned just a hot topics format because why do you need another podcast that just has the same opinions and the same stuff that's being, you know, spouted out by pretty much everybody else that's got a show? So we'll try to do something a little bit different. And partner, it's been so much fun. You've done a hell of a job with the booking of the guests. And as you know, as we evolve, as we move on, what are your thoughts and reflections on 100 episodes of the two-man power trip of wrestling? And where else do we go from here?
Chad, here we are,
episode 100. It's unbelievable that we've been able to get here so quickly. I mean, we just started basically in January of this year, and we're already at 100 episodes, and it's just amazing to be able to say that. And you know, it's funny, the reflections on 100 and our growth has been immense and amazing. I mean, now we moved from the podcast game, which obviously, you know, we've been great doing, and we're moving on to the booking game as well, which is fun, and we're hoping to do a lot more bookings with guys like Kevin Fertig, a.k.a. Kevin Thorne, a.k.a. Mordecai, and many more guys we're looking to book, and a lot of other guys. We have some surprises in store, so definitely stay tuned for, you know, to us for that, because we have plenty of more to announce, and possibly some more wrestlers added to the group, to the faction, to the stable, if you will. So, I mean, definitely looking forward to that. Also, can't forget to mention that we are the executive producers of the Del Wilkes documentary, The Patriot, which is just unbelievable and amazing. And Michael Elliott's great. Him and Elbow Docs is great. High Spots has been great. So just awesome to be a part of that project. And, you know, if it wasn't for the show, we wouldn't be able to be a part of that project. So check out the Del Wilkes DVD when it comes out, which should be very, very soon, as the DVDs I've heard from Michael Elliott are on its way back, and everyone should be getting it pretty soon. So I can't wait to see the final product on that. And it's so great to be a part of that. And just think back at the 100 episodes, and you can't help but think about, you know, one of our favorite episodes, one of our big episodes, and that was with the late, great Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. And it was just crazy to say that we were able to have his final interview, and all the coverage that we got from that, from E! Online to radio stations in New York, radio stations in Washington, D.C. I mean, it's just crazy to be a part of that. And it was just very sad, you know, especially since we just interviewed him 3 days earlier. To hear about his passing was just insane. But in a weird, you know, bittersweet kind of way, just totally, totally honored to have had his final interview. And, you know, just to interview him in general is just total honor. As we said, he's one of our top guys that we've loved, you know, throughout our combined 60 years. Can you believe that? Combined 60 years of wrestling fandom between us, Chad. So he's one of my favorites. And just think about, well, you know, where we've gone and from where we started is just amazing. And I love it. And I just hope we can keep the ball rolling.
Definitely, definitely going to keep the ball rolling. 100 episodes in, I think that the groundwork is there for another great 100 episodes in the books. And anybody who's ever clicked the download button, we thank you very much. And hopefully you enjoy what we've got in store for you today. And it's a man built for episode 100. And that is the magnificent Don Morocco. Morocco's obviously going to speak for himself. His resume, his history, his place in the history of professional wrestling is on another planet. He is always one of my favorites. His promo style, how he just carried himself in the ring, just always seemed like he was a monster. You always thought maybe he was a little evil. You know, he always played that sinister character, and you thought maybe there was a little bit of that inside. But Morocco truly is a showman. He truly is one of the greats of all time. And John, maybe I'll ask you this in this way, and that is, what would you say Don Morocco's place in the history of professional wrestling is? Especially when you put him up against some of those other names like you mentioned earlier, like Dusty Rhodes or Jesse the Body Ventura. And since Don Morocco does not do pretty much any kind of interviews, whether it's podcast, print, he's a guy that doesn't really get out there much. What would you say Don Morocco's place is in history?
You know, think about all the guys that we interviewed. I mean, you got, like I mentioned, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, Sergeant Slaughter, Jesse the Body Ventura, Kane, Dean Ambrose, coming soon. We have a lot of big names like Stan Hansen. So, you know, and many, many more. So please, you know, stay tuned with us for that. But it's just crazy to add another name. And the guy that we made episode 100, a guy we just interviewed, which was an amazing interview, was a guy that we felt was just awesome. Almost underrated, you know, to a point, but, you know, definitely a remembered legend, a WWE Hall of Famer, a two-time WWF Intercontinental Champion, and that is Don Morocco, and his place in our history is very, very high, as we, you know, obviously make him episode 100, and we feel that this is a special, special interview. Like you mentioned, he does not like to do a lot of interviews. He hasn't done a lot of interviews, especially podcast-wise, so, I mean, we felt totally honored, and it was such a privilege to get the Rock, the magnificent Morocco, on with us, just amazing. And you think about his place in history. I mean, he's a WWE Hall of Famer. He's in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame up there in New York. So just, he's awesome. And you remember him with his feud with Jimmy Superfly Snuka. I mean, that's one of the best feuds ever. And you just think of the heat that those guys had, and the cage match, and the blood, and the, I'm gonna kill you, Morocco. And it was just one of those feuds where you know two guys have such great chemistry and they mesh so well, and you know they had it. And like I mentioned in a couple previous episodes, a feud that I loved so much was Steve Corino and Homicide, and you think about the blood, the hatred, and the heat. Well, that feud, you know, basically was huge back in the 80s with the blood, the heat, and the hatred, and that was Snook in Morocco, and was one of the greatest feuds of all time, and it's one of those things that will never, ever be forgotten, and Don Morocco as a wrestler, and Don Morocco went with that feud with Snuka, will go down in history, and obviously we're going to hear a lot about Jimmy Snuka in this interview, so stay tuned for that. Some great stuff from the Magnificent One.
Now, obviously, it's not that it overshadows Don Morocco's career, but I think that sometimes along the line, you know, a guy like Snuka, albeit, you know, in the news for not the greatest of things as of late, has his place in history as one of the most beloved characters there's ever been. You know, he had such a huge following. He was such a guy, polarizing guy, that could get you in the seats and really get you to believe what he was saying. His promos were impassioned, and you really wanted to kill his opponents because you were so behind Jimmy Superfly Snuka that you were invested in this feud from Jimmy's point of view. But, you know, is Don Morocco going to just go down in history as the guy that Snuka landed on? And, you know, is he overshadowed just being the guy that laid there and caught Jimmy Snuka? Or by being there and being the guy that caught Jimmy Snuka, does he maybe cement himself on that same level as Jimmy did? But, you know, as you said, that feud is intense. That feud is one of the most, you know, crazy blood feuds you could possibly imagine. If you were going to make a top five of all time, I would definitely put Snuka and Morocco on there. I mean, the fact that it spawned some of the careers of some of the, you know, the newer generation of professional wrestlers, like, you know, Mick Foley gives it credit for that. Tommy Dreamer mentions it. I mean, it's something that really resonates with, you know, a lot of fans and a lot of people that have gone on to do some great things in professional wrestling. But is Don Morocco any bit overshadowed for being a part of the Jimmy Snuka feud as just the guy that Snuka landed on?
You know what? That's a funny question because, you know, sometimes you just think about that feud and maybe he is overshadowed a little bit, you know, where you say, oh, he's the guy that Jimmy Snuka landed on and, you know, in that feud. And, you know, maybe some people that aren't, you know, smart to the business or aren't clued in, maybe they think of it that way, but there's no way. I mean, his role in that feud is he's the one that made it. I mean, him being the heel, him leading all the matches, him being the man, you know, that people wanted to literally kill. I mean, if you look at the MSG crowds then, in New York, they were so hot, and they just wanted to kill Morocco, and, you know, obviously, and they wanted to Snuka to win. They wanted Snuka to kill Morocco, so, I mean, his role in that feud is just, you know, picture perfect, and you really look at him and his role in general as just a heel. You could say as the Intercontinental Champ two times as he beat Pedro Morales both times, you know, he could say, you know, he was the number two guy, so on and so forth, but he was probably the number one heel for a while for the WWF. I mean, he was awesome. And if you go back and you listen to his promos, I don't think a lot of those promos would be considered PC today. I mean, a lot of, you know, not too much political correctness going on, and that's what I loved about it. And you just never knew what he was going to say with those promos. Very unpredictable, very funny, and just perfect heel. I mean, I love the heels, and you go back and you really, really appreciate them, and you really think, like, man, Don Morocco is one of, like, the original heels where you just say, this guy, you just hate him so much. But, you know, from our end, we love to hate him, and he was such a great heel, and he enhanced Jimmy Snuka, and he enhanced Pedro Morales in that feud. I mean, obviously Pedro was big time before then, but, you know, he seemed like he was winding down a bit. Boom, he's back in the forefront of the WWF feuding with Morocco. So he was just great, and I can't, you know, state this enough, that he was such a great heel that he got all these other guys over, and I really feel like he was maybe underappreciated in that role, but looking back, he was great, and he was a top guy in the WWF for quite a while.
And we talk about his big feud with Hulk Hogan on the house shows, and it did culminate in a Saturday night's main event match. So if you want to say maybe underrated as a heel, definitely. He was in that second tier. We actually, you know, wanted to get down and dirty, ask him if he had ever been considered for a world title run, and he gives us his very honest answer about that, whether or not maybe he should have had a world title run against a guy like Hogan back in 85, when especially he was at his peak of being evil and paired with the Devious One, as Gorilla Monsoon would call him, Mr. Fuji. But why don't we talk about really quickly before we get to throwing it to the interview? You know, when I first started watching, I hate to make it about myself, but when I first started watching, he was a heel, but he was teaming with the ace, Cowboy Bob Orton. And, you know, you're very impressionable when you're first starting to watch the wrestling product. And when Morocco turned face, I loved him. I was really into him, and he was paired up with superstar Billy Graham, and you had the Jesus Christ Superstar music. I mean, I got into the tie-dye and the Rock, the original Rock of the WWE, the Magnificent Morocco. Loved him as a babyface, was going hard for him in WrestleMania 4, was very upset when he lost in the second round to Ted DiBiase. But, you know, we got his take on his face run in the WWE. Didn't seem like he was that thrilled with it. Kind of maybe led to his departure, amongst some other things. But, you know, he didn't love it. I know you and I did, which is another one we always talk about. We throw back and forth. Loved that 88, 87, late 87, early 88 face Don Morocco. But, you know, you look at those stars of that era, and I guess pretty much all of them, you know, could be considered mega, mega icons of professional wrestling. But, you know, give your take. Did you love that 1988 face run as much as I did?
Yeah, that 1988 or so when he turns face, a lot of people look back at it and they kind of don't like it. And we interviewed, you know, Morocco, obviously, and he said he didn't like it. He preferred playing the heel. He'd rather not be the face. And they put him in the tie-dye and they pair him up with superstar Billy Graham and obviously that awesome theme song. So it's just, you look back and he didn't like it maybe so much, and maybe some fans look back on it, didn't like it. But me and you, you know, we always talk about this feud. It's funny. We absolutely loved it for some reason. We just felt that it was kind of cool to see him as a face after being a heel for all that time. It was kind of a cool change up, and we liked the tie-dye. We liked, you know, him being the original The Rock. We liked him with superstar Billy Graham, who obviously, you know, is a god in the wrestling business. So I thought it was a cool changeup. I really did love it. I don't know why. It's just one of those things that, you know, I was a kid growing up. I you know, I enjoyed, you know, seeing him get beat up. And then when he turned face, I just really, really enjoyed it. And I really liked it. And it's funny because those stars from that era, him included, are just mega, mega icons in wrestling. And there's no, you know, if, ands, or buts about it. I mean, during that period, you have so many big stars. Like I mentioned, superstar Billy Graham, obviously Hulk Hogan, Macho Man, you know, eventually the Ultimate Warrior, and so on. But that era of wrestling, with Jimmy Snuka obviously included with Morocco in there, it's just the era of, like, the icons. I mean, those guys are just, you know, maybe it's because I grew up in that era, maybe because, you know, Chad, obviously you grew up in that era, but unbelievable. They're icons, they're legends. They're gods to us in there, and we just love that era, and we love the Magnificent Morocco, but I got to be honest, we also love The Rock, Don Morocco.
I love it. It's so true. Love The Rock, Don Morocco. Still kind of, you know, that he didn't make it in WrestleMania 4, but that's okay. We did love the Macho Man winning as well, so that's all good. 1988, Chad, he'll get over it eventually. With that being said, John, we just want to remind everybody that today's episode 100 is brought to you by Meowbox and Meowbox.com, and when you enter the code POWERTRIP10 in all capital letters into the promo box on Meowbox.com at checkout, you're going to save 10% off your first box subscription, courtesy of Meowbox, courtesy of Meowbox.com, and because you are a listener of the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. And again, we cannot thank you enough. 100 episodes in the books. Go back and listen to as many of these as possible. If you want to hear more, listen to the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling Business, spouted out by my partner, Primetime John Paz. Give us a ring and give us a shout. Tell us what you want. Tell us if you want to hear something. Reach out and touch us. But Primetime, I'm going to hand it over to you. Hit him with a little Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling Business and tell him a little bit more about Meowbox.
Oh, yeah, Chad. Meowbox. Meowbox.com. They have a service called One Box Can where every Meowbox purchased, you will give a can of food to a shelter cat. So it will be donated to a cat on your behalf. And again, that is One Box Can from Meowbox. Also with Meowbox, all edible items are made in the USA or Canada. And if you have a piggy cat like mine, Lucy, who we just got a Meowbox in the mail today as I say this, which was great, all my items in that Meowbox are replaced. All the edible items, they have been replaced because she does have a very, very picky diet. So we actually replaced them with toys and surprises, and there was some catnip in there, and she got a little crazy with the fake mouse. So the toys and surprises were awesome for Lucy, and she loved them. So you can replace the edible items if you so choose. So please, that's meowbox.com, promo code POWERTRIP10 for 10% off your first subscription. Again, it's meowbox.com, promo code POWERTRIP10. Now for some TMPT business. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Wrestling Pal and at Two Man Power Trip. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes. Please leave us a review. We would love to hear your feedback. Check out prior episodes with the late great American Dream Dusty Rhodes, good old JR Jim Ross, Sergeant Slaughter, WWE's Dean Ambrose, WWE's Kane, Scrap Daddy himself, Adam Pearce. Two episodes with one of my favorites and one of Chad's favorite guests, Austin Idol, Harley Race, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and so many others. Also, please subscribe to us on YouTube, where we also have a ton of great clips up, and check out the ones that we put up with Jesse the Body Ventura. I guarantee you will love that. Also, please check out the website, tmptofwrestling.com. That is tmptofwrestling.com. And also, you can check us out on the I-95 Sports Network. So please put it into the little Google machine and type in the I-95 Sports Network and search for the Two-Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You will love that because we release best of episodes every week, and you will really enjoy that. So again, that's the I-95 Sports Network. Also, please, if you want to book former WWE and ECW superstar Kevin Thorne, a.k.a. Mordecai, a.k.a. Kevin Furtick, please email bookings@tmptofwrestling.com. That's bookings@tmptofwrestling.com to book the legendary Kevin Thorne, a.k.a. Kevin Furtick, a.k.a. Mordecai. Now, without any further ado, we send it to episode 100. The man, the myth, the legend. The man, the beach bum from Hawaii. He is The Rock. He is the magnificent. He is the former 2-time WWF Intercontinental Champion. He is a WWE Hall of Famer. Folks, he is none other than Don Morocco.
Today is one of the biggest honors we've had to date here on the Two-Man Power Trip of Wrestling, because not only is our guest a WWE Hall of Famer, he's a former Intercontinental Champion, but he may also be regarded as one of the most sinister villains to ever step foot in the squared circle and be a vital part of some of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. You can call him the original Rock, you can call him the very first King of the Ring, or you could even call him the Beach Bum. But to us, he truly is magnificent, and he is the magnificent Don Morocco. Thank you so much for joining the Two-Man Power Trip of Wrestling.
Oh, thanks for having me. Just don't call me late for dinner.
Totally will not. But, yeah, like I said, we're thrilled to have you. It's such an honor. And I guess, you know, the easiest question to ask you is how you been and what have you been up to?
Been good. Getting old, working on aging. I just in the process of retiring from 24 years of longshoreman.
All right.
So Yeah, I did. I've been back here in Hawaii working down the docks for the last 24 years. And I'm diving deep into retirement, real deep.
Very nice. Now, did you become a longshoreman after you retired from the ring, or did you wait a little bit before you you got back into...
A little bit. It was a little bit. I kind of, did some promotion and did some other stuff. Did a little bit of independent, little ECW. But, then I just decided to go, It came up and it was a new profession and interested me, and beginning the work was real hard. And, I ended up a clerk. So I got two, I guess. But it was an interesting life.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, you mentioned ECW. One of the things, I think it's almost a trivia question at this point, because it was so hard to see that ECW footage for such a long time, that you're a former ECW champion. And that early part of ECW is funny because there was a lot of guys that had very familiar faces to the wrestling business that were coming in and out of ECW. And it's kind of like a who's who of the, some of the more veteran stars. But what are some of your memories of that time in ECW? Do you look back fondly on that right before you retired?
It was a trip. I got them, a few of the guys that, a lot of professional independent guys, Kalua and a lot of, Tom Brandy and a lot of those guys. They worked a lot of the independent circuits. So I got to meet a bunch of those guys. And it was a different, it was different for being spoiled in the WWFE. It was there. And, there was a little hustle going on to it and stuff. It was a job. I just spent a lot of time into it. And I was into it. But, then later on, see a lot of these guys come through and become become stars after a while.
Yeah, totally. And that crowd, that Philadelphia crowd, was so passionate and helped build that original ECW to, crazy heights in terms of the cult popularity. And, like I said, a lot of familiar faces there. And, of course, one guy who you were linked to for a large part of your career is also in ECW at the time. Actually, played both a heel and a babyface, and that's the Superfly, Jimmy Snuka. What were your memories of getting back in with him around ECW? Did you guys recreate some of that old magic?
I don't believe so. I don't know. You can check the records. I don't know if we did much together. We might have done a tag. I wasn't there really that long. I was living in Hawaii. Coming in, came in to drop the belt to somebody or something I came in to get the pass the belt to Tito, I think. I came in, I was just coming in. I just came in to did a couple shows here and there at the time for him. So I was just there for a fast couple, 3 months.
Yeah, and you mentioned losing to Tito. He also had a pretty good run in that original ECW. But let's if we could just go back to Jimmy Snuka for a minute. Obviously, we all know the infamous moment. It helped spawn careers for the next generation of superstars. It's one of the most visually impressive moments in pro wrestling history, like I mentioned at the top of the show. But what do you remember about looking up at the Superfly as he's about to come down? And thinking, did you have a feeling at that point that there could be a change in the landscape of pro wrestling after he jumped off that cage?
We were going through a whole change at the time. It wasn't Hulk Hogan yet, but it could have been. The business was doing so well and had been doing so well. It kind of followed. It picked up, I told Bruno, I was talking to Bruno one time. I said, I got it from Rocca, Rocca got it from him, we got it from Bruno and Backlund and those guys, it just passed on. So the business in the Northeast there was always fabulous, and then with the growth of television and the incorporation of TV and, cable TV and yada, yada, yada. You know, it was just a natural progression, I think.
Oh, yeah, totally. And some of those matches that you had, you know, in the Northeast and specifically at Madison Square Garden, I mean, you know, they just, it's a raucous crowd. You were such an awesome, awesome bad guy, villain, heel, whatever you want to call it. Your promos literally talk people in the building, maybe more to try to get to you than to actually watch the match, because you were so good with how you presented your promos. Did you like working that Northeastern crowd, you know, maybe more than some others because they were easy to agitate?
You loved it, yeah. Well, I had, I thought I was pretty hot as a, I watch every once in a while, catch old tapes of myself, you know, and I go through on my iPhone and stuff and catch some stuff, and I see, I watch, you know, the first 5, 8, 10 minutes. All I do is get the shit kicked out of me, you know, and but the people are popping the whole time. You know, they never seem to come down or to get enough of it, you know. So it's just, it was an entertaining time. To have the people, you know, everything so hot and everything around you going on so hot, you know. Because I would just, I look at the matches now and, you know, it's just one comeback after another. But they were, you know, they're loving it and they're having a good time. And Beach Bum was going wild. So, you know, it's great.
You literally could close your eyes if you're a longtime fan like John and I. You could just see, you know, you could see in the backstage area with either, you know, with Vince or with Gorilla Monsoon, and just, you know, just amping up the, you know, the crowd, the television crowd, talking about a Jimmy Snuka or, you know, or a Pedro Morales or a Ricky Steamboat. You know, but if I can, just with Jimmy Snuka, you guys, like I said, are so tied to one another. Did you find it easy to go after a guy like Snuka with some of the things you said in your promos? Like, was it something that was so, like, did you guys have a good relationship where you could kind of go that little extra limit and kind of jab him a little bit just to get him more riled up? Because there's the infamous him throwing the chairs, Morocco, Morocco, you know. And was that something you guys kind of had a good rapport with?
Probably. We broke in about the same time. I was back here wrestling in Hawaii. I had wrestled in Vancouver and Portland at the same time, and then L.A. for a couple of months, and then I came back out here in Hawaii. I hadn't been in the business more, maybe a year, maybe not quite, and Frankie Lane was breaking Jimmy in. So we, you know, started the buggy, and that's where we, you know, became familiar with one another. And then Portland and Minnesota and, you know, on down the road, yeah. So probably, yeah, it was easier. And, you know, we communicated. Polynesians, you know, we worked for each other and wanted to see each other, you know, both get over.
So, now, obviously,
you know, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, obviously, you know, Jimmy Snuka has been in the news a little bit, not for, you know, some of the finer things, you know, in his career. Unfortunately, you know, he published a book and said things in a book that kind of caught the eye, you know, of people with the, you know, with the old court case that had always been kind of out there. But was that ever something that, you know, and I don't mean to damper it a little bit, was that something that, you know, was known about at the time, or was that kind of just everybody had their own business going in their own directions?
I don't know. I was right there around it the whole time. It was the week after we just shot the thing where he threw all my clothes off and I hit him with the microphone and stuff. So I had the same night. It was a big lot of coincidence. Eddie Gilbert, remember Eddie Gilbert?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
The young one, the Tommy Gilbert's son.
Mm-hmm.
He had run his brand new Lincoln Town Car up the back end of a semi-truck and got drugged down the freeway. He called me in the middle of the night, and that's how I ended up, you know, crossing over with all the state troopers and everything else and how I got involved. But, you know, that's, it was quite a, yeah, I could see my whole future going down the drain there for a while.
Yeah, it's, looking back, I mean, that's, those rides you think about, anything could happen when you're going between towns, and some of those rides seem to maybe be a little bit longer than others. But do you remember those trips to Allentown? Maybe sometimes you never knew it was on the other side of that road.
Yeah, I mean, that was, those are the good old days. Back in Allentown and Hamburg, and back to either Connecticut or New Jersey, wherever you lived. At the time, that was those places were, that was good old time wrestling.
Now, with obviously, you mean Jimmy Snuka is in the news a lot and the issues, but what was your relationship like with him like today? Do you still have any contact with him? You know, obviously, you guys awesome feud and you guys were rivals, but were you guys friends outside the business? And do you have any contact today?
I talked to him I was talking to him on the phone till he started having his medical issues, and I haven't spoken to him for a while. His wife wanted me to see him next week or thereabouts when I'm up in New Jersey. I'm doing All Stars or that show up in Jersey, and then I was trying to, she wanted me to say hello to him, to, kind of perk up his spirits, hopefully.
Yes, definitely. I mean, his name has been thrown around there a lot lately and a lot of crazy, crazy stuff. But, obviously that was a great feud for you. But speaking of great feuds, if I could tune a little bit and change the subject, was a great wrestler that you had – many icy title, the Intercontinental title once you won it from the WWF, and many feuds there with Pedro Morales. What was it like working with Pedro and winning the IC title?
It was good. I didn't have too many guys. I didn't have everybody that didn't enjoy working with, everything was right, with the crowd and, all the reaction and everything was right there, so it was all good. We didn't have to work real hard to get the people up, because the people were pretty well jazzed. So pretty much a lot of what we did just got over, and which made for a good and easy match. Because there was just that much momentum and stuff in the territory at the time, so it's a lot of things are relative, how the territory is and the way that people take the different type of workers and the different type of work the guy does. Pedro was a solid, real solid, rugged guy and had a mass appeal. So he was, I've always enjoyed working. I heard he's fallen on health problems too. So I wish him the best, and his family. But yeah, I was, he was always cool with Pete. In fact, I've worked with him, several places. I think in San Francisco territory, a couple other places where he was around. Florida, maybe. I don't remember when I was a healer, maybe. I think once when I was a heel, when I turned heel after, I don't know. But I've been, with Pedro several times.
Your feud with him was, great, and it led to you winning the IC title twice, and you had two very, very long reigns, especially today, speaking of very long reigns, once was a year, once was almost a year. With the IC title back then, it was a lot more prominent than it is now. Did you feel that, you basically, Mr. McMahon at that point, Mr. Senior, was giving you the ball and you were becoming one of the faces of the WWF?
Yeah, kind of. I kind of felt that, more than just a title per se, that it had some meaning. And some backing, some some momentum behind it as far as, you know, the Intercontinental Champion and stuff. And that, you know, Pat Patterson, Slaughter, and those guys had done a good job building it up. So just continuing in that vein, you know, stuff was, everything was pretty laid out, you know, pretty well for you. Your fault, you know, if you fumbled, it was your fault, because the crowds and the people were certainly receptive to whatever was going down, if it was going down good.
Such a hot territory. New York was, you know, booming. The WWF was doing great. And, you know, Vince Sr. obviously was doing great, but obviously when Vince Jr. took it over, it was a whole different ballgame. What's the difference between working for Vince Sr. and working for Vince Jr.?
Well, man, you know, it's apples and oranges. It's two different times. You know, Vince Sr. was an old promoter in the old days, you know, and he had his area and his promotion and, you know, his territory. You know, it was, you know, everybody, Atlanta, Florida, Georgia, you know, Carolinas, everybody, Crockett's, Watts, California, you know what I mean, Vern Gagne, AWA. So you know, Vince Sr. was, you know, even graceful, you know, a gentleman, you know, and then you know, not that Vince Sr. is, the Jr. isn't, but, you know, honorable type, classy kind of guy, you know. And then Vince got in, new generation with network, you know, with cable TV and the network, and then pay-per-view and every, you know, marketing and commercials and cartoons and, you know, this and that, you know. So Vince was your senior, was your traditional promoter in an area that was just, you know, was an outstanding area, and, you know, it was hard for him not to be a real classy guy. And then Vince Jr. is just, you know, the wild man he seemed, you know, pushing and taking a chance. And, you know, he was part of that Evel Knievel dive over Grand Canyon and stuff like that. So, you know, different type of guys, you know.
And
but
one
it was
guy...
interesting. I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry to cut you off. Yeah, definitely.
No, just the transition, you know, from that. I was lucky to be part of the transition from the Vince McMahon Sr., Eddie Graham. Well, Crockett was still going wild at the time. But all that, Jim Barnett era, Vince McMahon. I mean, not Vince McMahon. Vern Gagne, all that type of transition into the junior, Vince McMahon Jr. is a high wire act. You know, that was it was entertaining and enlightening. And now to watch him, you know, it's still entertaining.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And, you know, one of the main players for Vince McMahon Jr. was Hulk Hogan. And, you know, they put the WWF title on him at Hulkamania. And, you know, he soared to new heights. And one of his greatest feuds was with you for the WWF title. Did you ever think that maybe, you know, you were going to get the WWF title? Or were you kind of happy just being involved in the feud?
There was a chance I could have got it. But well, by that time, they'd gone a whole different direction. I mean, there was a possibility, you know. I suppose my name was in the hat, but I doubt if it was ever a serious consideration. Although I did care, you know, maybe the earlier when I was doing the Magnificent Morocco and that type of thing would have been. But, you know, it was I cared enough heat with that Intercontinental Championship where they didn't need me as a world champion to draw money, because the world champion was doing his bit with the other heel that would be in at the time, you know, whoever, Mass Superstar or Big John Studd or whoever happened to be the second, you know, like the 1 and 1A heels that they had going. 1A, 1B, you know, all the different heels and stuff that they had going in the WWF at the time.
And at that time, they stepped
in. I'm sorry?
I was going to say, at that time, they kind of went into a little bit, you know, obviously more sports entertainment, and they had Fuji General and, of course, Fuji Vice when they teamed up with Mr. Fuji, which was awesome. Do you love that pairing? Because, you know, watching it on TV and watching it on tape and stuff, it was so much fun. It was so entertaining with you and Mr. Fuji.
Well, but I go back way back with Fuji, even before Snuka. I knew him. And he was... He'd be down. I knew him from Dean Higuchi, who became Dean Ho, who was Tony Garea's tag partner at one time.
Mm-hmm.
He had a gym in Waikiki where I worked out. That's how far back I go with Fuji. So yeah, it was an easy pairing, you know. And Fuji's insane anyway, so it was a trip to be around.
Did you like doing those sketches, the Fuji Vice and stuff? Did you find that fun and entertaining for yourself?
Oh, God, they were so bad. I don't know. You know, it's hard really liking that. It was okay. It all got done. It was kind of fun, I guess. But he had some grandeur to it. I don't remember they flew me back from Hawaii early. I was on vacation. They picked us up, my wife and two kids in a limo, and drove us to, they'd rented a bar. I suppose it had been closed that night, but a nightclub atmosphere where we did some little scene, about 10 minutes, and that was it, you know. That was kind of where they were running at the time. It was, Fuji Hollywood, there was walking up to these Hollywood gates, and the guards running us off. It was some bizarre stuff. That comedy bit that made me do was insane. The idea always being the worse the better. And we always lived up to that because it was pretty, most of the stuff was pretty hard. They gave you the script right there, you know, and you just, everything was hot. You didn't know anything, or they weren't going for any, you know, acting skills or anything like that. They just wanted to deliver it, so the more outlandish, the better.
And the funny part is the parallel between, you know, the two, that actually you guys were playing these devious bad guys, and coming off as these cheeseball, you know, sketches that, you know, you guys are fumbling over lines. You know, the acting is, somewhat subpar, but it was pulling off both sides of the spectrum. Now, did you like showing the lighter side of the Magnificent Morocco at that point? Because as we said earlier, the promos were so intense, but this was the lighter side of the Magnificent One.
Oh, yeah, it was all good at that time, you know. Everything was a new experience. It was all a lot of fun at the time. You know, crazy.
Sure, and you know, and actually, I want to mention really quick, and I hate to say this, but unfortunately, the passing of Rowdy Roddy Piper earlier this year, and you know, we've known from stories that have been told, they're like mythical, legendary stories at this point, about Rowdy Roddy Piper and his ways back in the day, and you know, you were one of his riding buddies, one of the guys that he loved to talk about. What are your memories of the Hot Rod, traveling with the Hot Rod, and is there anything that specifically stands out to you when you think of him in retrospect?
Oh, yeah, I was a shock. But there was I met him in 76, but I think he came down, was in L.A. before, because my parents, I was down around Santa Monica. And I don't know if I was working San Francisco or coming down when he was doing the Chavo feud. Him and Chavo, they were doing good business in L.A., you know, comparatively. was right around then. Actually, before that, when he came riding in some old, one of those old beat-up cars in a pit bull into Texas. And, that was like 74.
Wow.
We'll go back quite a ways.
Yeah, it's some of those stories, like I said, they're, you know, the things that, like, you almost sit there and you go, wow. People getting away with stuff like that is that's amazing to hear, but it's so entertaining. And, you know, it's funny, you know, you talk about meeting him back in 74, you know, in California. You think about the territory system and how, you know, that really absolved once the WWF went national. Did you love the territory system? Did you like going from one place to another, working new crowds? Or did you think it was something that was going to go away at some point?
Oh, no, well, I was barefoot and stupid. I just happened to get a job in those days, you know, to be working, you know, and learning and working my way up, you know. And there were older guys that were over and stuff at the time, you know. So it was just, barefoot and pregnant, you know. Just take it, whatever. Then I had a different because I ran and went to the Minneapolis. I had an AWA run real early in my career, so which helped kind of elevate me. Lord Blair's sent me on that with Vern Gagne, so it elevated me a little bit, where I had a little bit of a little bit of leverage with the offices before they became, you know, out of sight.
Do you have a personally favorite territory that you went through?
Some for different reasons, you know. Florida, just for the fun and the craziness, you know. When I was in San Francisco for work, Roy Shires, used to live in Santa Cruz, surf all the time. So that was a great life. Surfing and I was working too. But, you know, we literally set the world on fire with paydays, but you know, it was getting by. There'd be a cow palace in there, you know, occasionally. To make things go all right, but I'm going to the kindergarten here now with my grandson. I left too early too, but yeah, no. Jeff Florida was great. Atlanta was fun. You know, all those territories were, you know, wild and woolly back then. When I went to Minnesota, I was probably too young to appreciate, you know, just left Hawaii and cold and the snow and the, you know, all the freezing and stuff up there was, I didn't like it, although I was making tons of money. And you know, it wasn't too good. I wasn't grateful, I guess, you know, because it was, I just hated living there. But, you know, I guess I'm probably too, you know, a little immaturity in youth had a big part to do with that. As if I'd, you know, been worried about the money, I just would have hung in there.
Now, speaking about, you know, making money and stuff, when you were in the WWF and they turned you face and, you know, they put the tie dye on you, they put you on Superstar Billy Graham, as your manager, and they made you the Rock. Did you like the face turn? Was that, you know, financially good for you? And did you actually like being a face rather than being the classic Magnificent Morocco heel?
I didn't care for being a face. No, not after all those. It was, you know, it was changed. I was getting. I was slow. I'd slowed down by then anyway. You know, so I wasn't too. I wasn't too thrilled with it, but. You know, aside from that, it was okay. By that time, we're pretty much on a salary, more or less, anyway. they kept you in a pay range at that time. So, and I was getting towards the end of my wrestling.
With that period, did you really rather stay the heel, and didn't want to really turn face, and that did that kind of like leave the departure?
No, I just, you know, had a couple run-ins with guys and, you know, just,
My mom's here.
Oh, she is?
Yeah.
We're going to go home with her?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, hello?
Yep.
Okay. All good. My daughter's picking up my grandson. So...
No problem.
I'm good. Okay, keep working. I'm good to go now.
All right.
Yeah, no problem. I was going to say, do you feel like the locker room changed, you know, right before you left the WWF? Did you feel like there was a big change and a big shift, and that was maybe some issues that you were having backstage?
Oh, maybe a little bit. But, you know, it wasn't bad. I hadn't noticed it, no. By that time, it was still pretty, you know, pretty normal. It was going through. It started to change. I said the Dynamite got his teeth knocked out, and you know, a few things are going down. So I suppose there had been a turn, you know, and the agents were you know, kind of stepping up and taking the heat for the office stuff. You know, the office wanted to do things, but would rather do it through the agent, you know, than get the heat on themselves. You know, get rid of one of the guys or something. Something like that. But we all had everybody got an opportunity. Everybody, I read that I kind of follow once in a while that Dan Spivey and Billy Jack Haynes feud.
Oh, yeah.
That's going on, and you know, everybody made money, and everybody, you know, chose to go their own way. You know, once the matches were over, there was nothing, you know, nobody holding a gun to your head to do anything, or, you know, anything coming down. You know, because I think I'm going to see Daddy next week. In New Jersey at that Hall of Fame and signing or whatever they call it.
Well, you actually, we recently had on Dan Spivey, and obviously we got his take on it, and obviously it's way different than the Billy Jack Haynes take on it. What's your take on it? Whose side are you more for?
I would have to be more for the personal responsibility, you know. Although we were getting run really hard, you know, that's I don't know, you know, you have to take, yeah, I guess I would follow Spivey, where you have to take responsibility for yourself, you know. I just saw that tape of Led Zeppelin and Jimmy Page and all those. Four of them and the big, I think it was a girl from Heart doing it, the Stairway to Heaven. Remember how, you know, oh, they're still surviving. You know, Led Zeppelin's still going. A lot of wrestlers should be able to. Some guys stuck in. But yeah, I think Daddy Spivey is a. I think you're kind of responsible for yourself when it comes to addiction and you know, take care of your brand and stuff. Because we're all afforded the opportunity and then make money. And then when you lose it, you know, I guess when you're knocked off your high, you're a high horse, you probably want to blame somebody else, you know. when somebody's making more money than you, and you're envious or however you want to put it. So yeah, that would probably that may be a deterrent.
Yeah, I feel like perhaps I'm more for Spivey for sure, because I think that Billy J. King worked, many other different territories besides just the WWF, and he's blaming Vince for all his problems. But speaking of working, many territories, you actually, had the privilege of working, basically everywhere, Canada, obviously USA, everywhere, obviously big time in Hawaii. But you wrestled for New Japan Pro Wrestling, you wrestled in Japan for the War promotion as well. What was it like working in Japan? Did you sense it's a lot different than working in the States?
The work is the same. The crowd is different. The first time I went there was real weird. And then you kind of get used to it. There's the lack of no reaction from the crowd and stuff like that. The clap, muffled sound, and then the guys like Abdullah and those guys coming in. But it's kind of good. It's got to be great now with all the VC, the DVDs and cables and stuff. Back in those days, it was just Japanese. Everything was Japanese. And with all the cable and DVDs and all that stuff. Now you could spend 6 weeks there and stand on your head. But the matches are good. They're good. I used to work a lot with Jumbo Tsuruta and Fujinami. When I was young, man. When I first started going there, because I was one of those baby faces that, I worked with Fujinami and with Inoki, and then worked a lot with Jumbo too. And most of the time, Philly matches the 30-minute Broadways or the 45-minute Broadways. The rest of them, so they could get all their stuff in. So it wasn't bad. Every once in a while, I'd get the Abdullah or Tiger Jeet Singh or one of those guys' partner. 15 minutes of fire extinguishers and whatever else that goes on. Wild crazy shit. Very good time.
That's great. You can have that kind of different matches, because obviously Abdullah Butch is a lot different than wrestling a legend, like Jumbo Tsuruta. And speaking of, going the complete opposite spectrum and having matches, there's a match I haven't been able to find that I don't know if there's footage of, but I really want to be able to find it. It's you from Florida against Jack Briscoe. Do you remember that match? Because I'm reading all this stuff online. I desperately want to see it because I heard it's a great match to kind of put you on the map as a big star.
I remember we had a Indian strap match at the Bayfront one time, and probably a couple other matches, and I think in Charlotte we worked a few times when we were both when I turned heel in Charlotte for that summer I was there. But if Sully would be on, or the Briscoes have those tapes, so that there would be the ones to. I like to see the one with me and Koloff in the cage. That one was pretty extraordinary, I think. When I was a baby face, had long hair and curls and a mustache. And Koloff was like a machine. Just boom, 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 boom. And we built up to a cage match in Bayfront in St. Petersburg, which ended up a pretty cool match. I think he was on the card. Dusty and Terry Funk were on the card for the – Terry just got the NWA. He just got the NWA title. And Dusty and Terry were on top for the title. That's the other guy I spent a lot of time with, too, Dusty.
Oh, yeah.
In the floor. Yeah. He used to call me his favorite heel, but I think he told that to all the boys. they were his favorite. As long as he was going over, they were all his favorite heels.
He worked him a lot in the AWA, too, Florida and the AWA, right?
Yeah, AWA, too, yeah. Him and Murdoch and Ricky and Ric Flair. Ric Flair at the Otis Gagne's farm. Him, the Sheik, Ken Patera, Bobby Bruggers, Brunzel, and Greg Gagne. That was their class. And I go to after Robinson and Joe Scarpello and Danny Hodge and those guys would go up and beat the shit out of them. Well, try and beat the shit out of them. And then they'd see me and just start glowing. I'd come in and do regular wrestling high spots and, you know, drop down, get it again, headlock, you know. They were just elated to be doing some real professional wrestling and not getting the shit kicked out of them for a change. But we worked hard, though, but I was in that barn, Greg Gagne's barn, where Flair was there. He was about 310 pounds.
Whoa.
He's a big guy. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked to Jim Brunzel not too long ago about that camp, and he definitely remembers some of those training sessions. And do you think that today's athlete could kind of hold up to what went on in that barn? And I guess what happened in that barn, will it always stay in that barn?
I don't know. They're doing some pretty crazy stuff right now. I watch a lot of the new techniques and stuff, and it's you know, to be able to do that's the kind of stuff we're doing back then. You know, that high intensity, high aerobic, high performance, you know, different types of training and stuff. And I see it in some of my daughter's tapes and stuff. These guys doing that stuff now, so yeah, I'm just, you know, but now they have a, you know, there's a better awareness, there's a better knowledge now. It's like, you know, better not be 65 years old and try any of that stuff, you know, be up for pounding or asking for pounding.
Well, actually, unfortunately, Sting suffered an injury at the show they had last night on kind of a tricky turnbuckle bump, and that's a great that's actually a great point, because you know the conditioning and the I guess the work that goes into you know, how a match is put on today versus how maybe, you know, when somebody broke into the business, you know, 20-30 years ago is a lot different. Have you like checked out today's wrestling scene, and you know, is it something that you saw the business, you know, evolving to with how it is today?
Some of the guys are pretty off the wall, and naturally start with the Cactus Jack, you know, Mick Foley, and you know, all the stuff he did. I still say he's the one that got The Rock over when he that's what got The Rock over when he had himself handcuffed behind his back. I don't know how many times he hit him with the chair, but it's kind of legendary how many times a Rock whacked him with the chair.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That whole scene there, you know, that was insane. You know, the Rock couldn't swing like a pussy either. He had to swing for the fences. You know, like he was, you know, well, there, you know, it was a big time match, and he was hitting some big-time shots. Yeah, some of that stuff is insane. But the other guy, Lonnie Bain, and a couple other guys used to take, you know, bumps like that, you know, had no regard. I mean, you know, look, he was doing that. He'd run and do that that elbow off the apron onto the cement. He was doing that in the house shows in front of 25 people. So, you know, he just, you know, had no regard for his body, you know, basically, I think. You know, it's just a matter of time. I mean, he just held together by screws. So a lot of them in the kid with the ladders and stuff, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, exactly. And Cactus Jack, you know, with that nut, you know, with that off the apron elbow, you know, took a beating on his knees, took a beating on his back, and maybe took some years off his career, but then, you know, moved forward, you know, with the ladders and the tables and things of that nature. Would the Magnificent Morocco have gone through a table had it meant, you know, returning business the following month?
Oh, Jesus, we're talking 40 years ago, you know. Probably, you know. Whatever, you know, it seemed like at that time you do whatever it takes, you know, and, you know, it's easy to be brave. You're 40 years removed for something like that and say, hell yeah. But, you know, it's, I don't know. I that one bump off the top of the cage, I would probably have that a lot more set up, a lot more room for error than what he had. That's for sure. But everything else, you know, but I suppose, you know, like, you know, you say, it's easy to sit back now and go, oh, yeah, sure. I would have done that. You know, money, you know, but I don't know.
You know, it's funny looking back at the, as you start to wind it down here, you know, just looking back, that snooker bump off the top of the cage, everyone gives him praise, but you're the one that, you know, had to take him, you know, 250-pound man falling down on top of you.
That's true. Yeah. That was, when he caught me just with his knee in the corner of my hip and kind of, you know, she jolted me there. But aside from that, everything else was, you know, naturally was like, you know, 12, 15 feet in the air. So, you know, couldn't have been that soft. So I caught as much as I could. And then, this is history.
You know, we actually, we had on an executive from Coliseum Video early in our run, and he mentioned an interview he did with you where basically you just said the same exact thing that he said, and he really puts you above the snooker leap as being, if it wasn't for Don Morocco, there wasn't going to be a snooker leap because he did have to land somewhere, and there was no better base than that big Don Morocco laying on that canvas.
Hip, hip, hooray. it is what it is, you know. Like old Red Best Dean used to say.
And it is what it is.
Sorry?
Oh, I was going to say we were talking you know, about that historic moment and that cage match and Jimmy Snuka. And you can look back at all these other awesome matches that you had, you know, against Hogan or Pedro Morales or Jack Briscoe, like you mentioned, or Jumbo Tsuruta. But do you have a favorite match or matches that you had in your career?
Some of, you know, the big ones stick out in your mind, you know. I don't know if they're the favorite matches. I remember one time in the Boston Garden, they popped so loud, it was, you know, it was incredible with Hogan and Snuka, me and Bob Orton. We did it for Hogan came up and Snuka had been down and Snuka came up and the people just kept going, getting higher and higher. But you know, there's a few others, you know, there's a lot of others, but you know, there was a lot of nights on the road and you know, a lot of hopefully most of the performances are up to par. I'm sure there were more than a handful to miss, you know, and didn't get a great reaction. But you know, most of them were up to par. I remember a few. You know, I'd have to go, you know, sit around and think, and stuff comes into my mind now. But offhand, you know, I don't. A lot of the Steamboat stuff and back different days in Florida, and, you know, in San Francisco, a lot of hot matches there, and Florida, Georgia, Bill the Butcher, those kind of things. The Houston, Texas with Mad Dog Vachon and stuff like that, you know. Just those bloodbaths and wars and, you know, all that kind of stuff. In New Zealand with Curtis, King Curtis and Mark Lewin and stuff. Australia, New Zealand. We had pretty good business going down there for a while. And that was pretty wild territory too.
Yes, definitely. Now, you know, we were talking about great matches and stuff. I mean, Guy, we kind of mentioned in passing before, but I actually wanted to go back to it. What about Ricky Steamboat? Did you enjoy working with Ricky Steamboat? Because I just remember those being classic matches.
Yeah. All those guys. Steamboat, Tito. Steamboat especially, but I think Tito too. Tito Osborne leaving by that time, but Steamboat was... or changing by that time. Steamboat would contribute a lot and go overboard to get matches over and stuff, as Tito, as everybody did, you know. But I remember Ricky was really meticulous. He was, you know, a little bit smaller, so he had, you know, had some other stuff. And there's he did a lot of nice moves that we were able to work into, you know, real violent type match, yet still have a lot of classical, you know, classical wrestling moves and stuff like that. And so, yeah, Steamboat was a good one. It was a real good one.
Who would you consider your favorite opponent? Would it be a Steamboat, or maybe was it a Jimmy Snuka, a guy that you had such a big time long history with?
No, God, I wouldn't. I don't know. Whoever made me the most money that night? I had a tiger. And the Hulkster. When the Hulkster used to come down, my skin used to pop too for I had a tiger. I said this before, but I don't know. Well, I realized recently with all the racial things and the stuff he got caught with. But then, you know, but previous to that, with the Dave Meltzer and the wrestling underground media as it is, and Hulk and the Ultimate Warrior and a couple of those guys were such horrible workers and such, you know, such boring performers, yet they were doing fabulous business, you know. Sometimes it's a little unjust that they get, you know, criticized for it. You know, you may not like somebody's style or somebody, you know, not everybody works like Ray Stevens and Dory Funk Jr., you know, probably the two greatest, you know, just natural, you know. But, you know, not everybody works like that, you know. Look at Bruno, all the success Bruno had, and his style to a lot of workers, you know, isn't the greatest. Yet, you know, look at the results, you know. And I think you hold Hogan to those standards, and then, I don't know. Seems like with the underground going around, Hogan comes out a bum. But I was there in those times, and the times everybody was fat. Everybody after I left, he kept going. He kept going, you know. So it was good times.
Yeah, it's crazy. Good times because. And I think it's the great Bobby Heenan said it. He's like, you know, that these guys consider, you know, Hogan not a good worker, yet he's filling the seats, so he must be the best worker that he's ever seen.
Yeah, you know. Well, you know, maybe The Rock's gone by that as far as, you know, taking it to the next level. But in his time, and his, you know, and everybody, you know, everybody dumps on him. Not everybody, but, you know, he seems like to be a favorite target to be dumped on. And I mean, being removed from Hawaii, and I was never part of his clique. So I don't have, you know, a dog in the fight. But I was never part of his clique with the guys, you know, used to follow him around and kiss his ass and stuff. And for work and for bookings and for places on the card and stuff. But you know, he was always seemed to be one of the guys, kind of. But, you know, he wasn't, you know, because he was the Hulk, you know, and he was on his own trip. He had the TV and the NBC and the movies and everybody coming after him. But he was different. He was different than the rest of us, whether you want to admit it or not. Huh.
Definitely, definitely true. Did you ever detect any racism from Hogan? Because obviously, you know, all this stuff has come out, but did you ever see anything? Because, and a lot of people are coming to his defense.
I never saw him as a racist or bigot or anything, you know. He got caught. It was stupid. He was, for a guy who spends that much time talking on, you know, publicly like we're talking now, you know what I mean?
Yep.
For a person who spends that much time being taped, you know, even it would be unthinkable if I would come up with it. You know, and I never do interviews and stuff. But for a person who spends that much time, it was pretty dumb. You know, it was, you know, pretty insensitive to go. I don't know if it was secretly being taped or what the story is or what the thing. But still, you know, with all that political correctness and stuff going down now, you kind of got to, you know, watch your P's and Q's all the time.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah, you totally have to. Oh, my God, yes. Totally. Now, Mr. Morocco, this has been absolutely, you know, an honor. And, you know, you said you don't do many interviews. So with that, we are eternally, eternally grateful. But before we let you go, one thing we like to end the interview with somebody of your stature is when you look back on your career and you look back at all the amazing things that you've done, what would you say the Magnificent Morocco's legacy is on the professional wrestling industry?
Worked hard, produced, hard worker, and just hard worker like a lot of other guys. Had a lot of friends, a lot of good friends. Roddy Piper, a lot of the guys that just passed recently. Dusty, love affair with him. In and out, you know. Good friend, bad friend, good friend, bad friend. Yeah, we were close. Went to Japan first time with him. Roddy was always close with him. Other guys, I heard Tony Charles just passed, and other guys, and, you know, other guys have gone, and a lot of guys living now. But just had a lot of friends and had a good time. Always had Dino Bravo. Always had a good time wrestling and enjoyed most of the people I was around all the time. So, yeah, it was a great life. And then I was lucky enough to move on to the docks, and now I'm retired officially. So I want to get into your business. I want to get into the broadcasting now that I got.
All right.
That I got free time. I want to do some podcasting or broadcasting from Hawaii. I got, you know Monica Mossman from Japan, All Japan Pro Wrestling?
Yeah.
He went up there right after, and he and I are trying to link up radio out of Tokyo and out of here, going back to the United States. So that's so he can do the Tokyo half or the Japan half, and I can do this half. Okay. But that's next week when I get up there in New Jersey. So I got to work on that. So thanks for having me.
No, no problem. Let me plug the date for you. It's October 3rd. It's Legends of the Ring, the Fan Fest. Some of your old friends are going to be there, and we really appreciate you coming on. But I just want to ask you, do you remember your line in the Land of a Thousand Dances video, the iconic rock and wrestling video? Do you remember Morocco's line?
I remember. Food, do you know how to, supposed to be, do you know how to pony? But I don't know how you mastered. I don't remember my line, no.
Well, if you would like some help, it's like Boney Maroney.
Okay, yeah. I was too taken with Fuji's line. I was always too taken with what Fuji was doing. Yeah, okay. I thought I changed. Maybe I might have changed the words around. Okay, like Boney Maroney. I'll go for that.